chapters 3 and 4. We've kind of moved past the introductory moments of the story, and we're starting into a little bit of the action. The most adventurous part is still yet to come, but instead of meeting the characters, instead of understanding the setting, we're now actually beginning this sea voyage and seeing where it goes from here. So as a quick recap, we are just a few years into the reign of King Caspian, and things are at peace and things are settled, and he's done a wonderful job so far as the king, and he is now in the position of fulfilling a vow that he took at his coronation. And what is this vow?
To go and find the lords who were exiled.
These exiled lords, or whatever the best description of it. I mean, it's a de facto exile, but when it's first described in Prince Caspian, it's almost, you know, this is a reward for you, but clearly Myraz wanted to just get rid of these guys. These were guys who were loyal to Caspian the Ninth, King Caspian's or Prince Caspian's dad. And unlike everybody else, they were not afraid of the sea. So already we're getting kind of a hint that these guys are different somehow. Why were the Telmarines afraid of the sea in particular? I always think that this is a significant thing that these guys were not afraid.
Aslan came from the sea.
And so while they didn't connect Aslan anymore, because, you know, that would be like a forbidden word or that nobody knows about because they suppressed all of the true Narnian history for generations. But it had grown up that the sea was untrustworthy or a terrible place because initially they were afraid of Aslan returning. Now, I'm going to suggest that these lords are the New Testament equivalent, or potentially the Old Testament equivalent, I suppose, of the God-fearing Gentile.
Oh, yeah.
Now, if you have ever come across that, for instance, say the centurion whose servant was sick unto death, and he goes to Jesus and says, "Would you heal my centurion?" Now, he gets an introduction by some of the disciples before he even meets Jesus, and they say, "Look, this is a good guy. Our people here will vouch for him. He is a God-fearer." Now, being a Roman, he was not a Jew. What would it mean for him to be a God-fearer? Well, it means this is a guy who is pious and righteous and honest, who is virtuous, and even though he may not be a Jew, he is an ally. And he may even worship God as the one true God, but because he's not a Jew, he is not in the tribe. So how do we describe these folks who may respect, acknowledge, or even worship God, but were not part of the family, and they would be referred to as most likely God-fearers? The Book of the Bible summary that we just got on Sunday was the minor prophet Jonah. Now, everybody knows the Jonah and the whale part, but why is Jonah in the whale? Because he runs away from God's command. What is God's command? To go and preach where?
To Nineveh.
Now, Nineveh is not a Jewish town.
Not a nice place.
Okay, Nineveh is the capital of the Assyrian Empire. The Assyrians are not Jews. They're the enemy. And so that's why Jonah runs away. He didn't want to go there, and he didn't want to preach to those people. But the amazing part of the Jonah story is that after he gets barfed up on the land, he does what he's supposed to do, and he preaches judgment towards Nineveh. How does Nineveh respond?
They respond. Put on ashes.
They completely do everything they can to repent, and God forgives them. They are spared their due judgment and destruction because they repented. This is a foreign, pagan, enemy nation. But faced with the truth of God Almighty, they respond. I kind of see within these lords an element of the God-fearer. We are not afraid of the sea. they don't have to bring up Aslan, because maybe they've never heard of Aslan. Maybe that's a thought that, other than a select few, died out generations ago. But there's something about the way that they're built. There's something about their temperament or whatever. And I see in these guys virtuous men, like the pagans of old who were virtuous pagans. This is the, you know, Cicero was not a Christian. Marcus Aurelius was not a Christian. Plato was not a Christian. But the people of the church have always seen them with great respect. That there's something about them in their hunting and in their searching for the truth. They actually stumble on part of it. And so that's kind of how I see these lords. Before we meet any of them, before we kind of figure out what they're exactly like, I'm going to toss out the suggestion that even though they may know nothing of Aslan on their journey, their distinction of being the only Telmarines, the people who occupied Narnia, the only Telmarines who were not afraid of the sea, I think represents an openness to Aslan, even if they don't know his name. What do you think about that?
I think
that it's one of those little underlying things, but I think it's there, and even if it's not there on purpose, I think it works for me to understand these guys, because he's not just going to rescue more people like Myraz. He's going to rescue more people like himself. Remember, Caspian, when he heard these stories, it was like, this is everything I hoped that would be true. So even before he knew them, Caspian himself was kind of prepped and prepared at some level to love Aslan. Okay, so we've now met the major players. Edmund and Lucy, the Pevensey children, are back. Peter and Susan are too old, and they're not, but someone has taken their place. Who has taken their place?
Eustace
Clarence Scruggs. And how might we describe Eustace in as few words as possible?
Arrogant,
jerk.
Spoiled.
Sulky.
Bossy. Yeah. Kid's pill. He really is. He is obnoxious. So we are now on Caspian's ship, the Dawn Treader, and they are still headed east. And they have left kind of what would be sort of normally easily comfortable, and they're headed to the edges of their knowledge. They are approaching the Lone Isles.
And all around them is water.
That's right, all around them is water.
Amazing that Lucy recognizes
Why does Lucy recognize these islands?
They must have gone there when they were kings and queens of Narnia.
That's right.
When they were in battle.
Well, what's the relationship between the Lone Islands and Narnia?
They are part of Narnia.
They're part.
They're like little feudal states or vassal states. How did that happen? Okay. Peter and Edmund don't conquer them. They think it's something that maybe that happened during the time of the White Witch. And here's the little Uncle Jack moment. So the narrator, every now and again, slips in something in just his little funny way of writing, which makes me imagine the kindly old uncle smoking a pipe in front of his fireplace who's telling a story, but every now and again just kind of pats you on the knee. And so, what does he say about this story about the White Witch potentially taking the Lone Islands?
Someday I may get around to writing a book about it.
Yeah.
Right. Yeah. You know what? I've never heard why, but if I do hear about it, I may write it down. It's just a cute little aside. So, at some point, Lucy and Edmund have been to the Lone Islands before. We've already heard her mention that old Narnia had big, beautiful ships, and they did traveling and stuff like that. Remember that they had the chance to really grow up as kings and queens before they went back to England. They were probably in their 20s or 30s. So over the, you know, decade or two that they reigned in Narnia, at some point they sailed to the Lone Islands. And so Lucy recognizes them. Edmund is kind of giving a rundown on the three it's either three islands or three major islands, and we've got one that has all the people.
Right, one that has sheep.
Mm-hmm.
Yep,
sheep.
Right. So Little Avra has a few people on it. You can't see it yet. Most people lived in Dorne, and the sheep were on Felipath. Mm-hmm. And Lucy has an idea. What's her idea?
She wants to go there.
Yeah.
Yeah. So they have to. They're now kind of in a, I don't know if a cove is the right nautical term, but they're so close into shore and they need to kind of weave in and out of these islands that if they're going to go to the main island Dorne, then they're going to have to row, and they need to row around the coastline of this uninhabited island. And Lucy knows from her memory that it's just this kind of beautiful natural place. So she gets the idea, maybe we can go.
Yeah.
And what does Caspian do?
So they get a little boat. I mean,
he wants to.
He says, okay, yeah, sounds like fun. And of course, who else goes along with them?
Eustace.
Yeah. Eustace the complainer. What, now, why is Eustace, why would they bring Eustace?
Just to get off the boat.
Yeah, just. Just who knows? Anything to shut this kid up. So there is another little Uncle Jack aside in there that this was very early in the voyage before Caspian knew better. Why would he bother to say that? Caspian agrees to this plan because he didn't know any better.
And he didn't realize the pirates were there, I think.
So what's going to happen is, yeah, they'll run into pirates. But this thought of just sending, you know, Caspian and Lucy and Eustace by themselves anywhere is maybe not a smart idea. You know, you don't know what you're getting into anymore. Mm-hmm. And to be completely unguarded like that is actually more dangerous than you realize. But that, you know, inexperience often puts us in positions that we don't realize how stupid it is. You know, sometimes we're just glad after the fact that we lived through it. So they get on this island, and they are surprised by meeting some people. What happens?
Well, they get taken prisoner.
That's right. Mm-hmm. They get taken prisoner, and who are these guys?
Slavers.
They're slavers. They're pirates, and they're slavers. So, they capture them, and that's kind of their whole deal, is that they are going to sell Caspian and his companions into slavery. What do you remember from their capture?
Eustace wants to know if he's going to be able to talk to the British consul.
He still wants to file a complaint with the British consul.
And the mouse.
Reepicheep, he's so funny.
Reepicheep is all over him, but what do they think about Reepicheep?
He's unique.
They're amazing.
Yeah, but it's like a circus act.
Yeah.
Yeah. Someone's trained him to respond like a parrot.
Yeah.
But he's not a... They cannot fathom that he's an actual talking animal. But because of the novelty, he's going to probably, you know, fetch a good price at market. Now, who are buying these slaves?
People from away, some other islands.
From some other country. Yeah. Mm-hmm. There is another country, Kalerman.
Yeah. Yes.
And Kalerman, we will meet more later. Mm-hmm. I think this is our first look at anyone from Kalerman. How would you describe, I think they're called Kalermeans, but anyway, we see at least a couple of traders from Kalerman, and how does Lewis describe them?
Big, scruffy, bearded.
No, those are the pirates.
Those are the pirates.
Those are the pirates. Yeah. The people buying the slaves from Kalerman, we see the next chapter.
They were in robes. And
okay.
Wise.
They were green and gold.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, they were wise.
Wise. There's something about wisdom there. Maybe think of the three wise men.
Okay.
Like that.
Yeah, now, in their description, when you get to them, and it, when we will run over this next chapter, and there are two books which deal quite a bit with Kalerman. The Horse and His Boy, as a matter of fact, happens almost exclusively in the Nation of Kalerman. And The Last Battle will have Kalerman as a character. They are most closely associated with probably an Arab sort of people, whether they're Arabic or Persians or, but you have kind of a Arabian Nights sort of feel to whenever he describes Kalerman. It, when we actually see it, it's going to be like the Middle East. And the people who come there will have sort of a somewhat swarthy appearance, and he'll mention their, whether it's their curved scimitars or their robes and the pointed shoes or whatever. But these are kind of like these this kind of medieval Arabic, Ottoman, Middle Eastern, Persian amalgam. And that seems to be the people most interested in the slave trade. As a matter of fact, how influential is Kalerman in the Lone Islands? There's a little detail tossed out that should tell you something. What is the currency in the Lone Islands? Okay, it's the Kalerman money. It's not Narnian money. It's the Kalerman money. You know, the Lone Islands nominally belong to Narnia, but who do they seem most influenced by? This other nation, Kalerman. Okay. So, they have been...
Caspian gets bought.
Okay, so they've been captured. They're going to be taken to market the next day. But before that happens, they cross into an area with little shops and people and stuff. And what happens to Caspian?
He gets bought.
He's bought.
Yep.
Okay. Some lordly guy comes out of an inn, maybe the owner of the inn or whatever, and he buys Caspian. There's even a little negotiation going on. Does this guy like the pirates?
No.
Does he like the slave trade?
No.
Well, then why would he buy a slave if you don't like the slave trade?
Get him away. His face was familiar to him.
Yes. He just wanted to save this young man. And he hates the slave trade. He's tried to stop it. He can't buy them all, though he wishes he could, but he can save this one. And why did he chooses Caspian? Because of his face. Why his face? What does his face remind you of?
Because he was the Lord of King Nine.
Mm-hmm. Reminded him of his father.
Reminded him of his king, King Caspian the Ninth. Who is King Caspian the Ninth?
Caspian's
father. And so, in this little conversation, they're able to figure out who one another is. That Caspian reveals himself as his true king and lord, and who is this guy? He's one of the seven. He is Lord Byrne. So, already, before we've set out into the wild unknown, we've already found one of the seven. Now, why, if he was to go out exploring, why is he here in the Lone Islands that are still kind of in the known world?
Because he fell in love, he married.
So Lord Byrne, they all probably took port. You know, they were all together early on. And while they were at port, which makes sense. You know, people know about this place, but it's the last known place. That's like when you see the billboard that says last gas station for 50 miles. You go ahead and pull off. So while they were visiting the Lone Islands, maybe resupplying, what happens to Byrne?
He finds himself a young lady.
Yes.
And decides, no more for me.
Yeah.
I'm going to settle down. And he does. And he raises a family, and he becomes pretty successful in the area. He sounds like he owns a fair amount of property. And he seems to be kind of an influential guy. Well, what does Lord Byrne, what can he tell Caspian about the current conditions of the Lone Islands?
They're governed by this Pug. No, Pug is the
Gumpus.
Gumpus. That's a pretty good name for a frumpy, dumpy, grumpy governor. Gumpus.
And that there are several ships involved with the slavers, so
you've
got to be careful.
Right. So, you know, Caspian wants to get his crew alerted, and then, well, let's just destroy the slaves here now. We're gonna just, you know, Pug and his seven or eight pirates can't stand up to my ship, so why don't we just take them now? And what's Burn's suggestion? Yeah, you've only come with one ship and 30 soldiers. That's fine for taking out 8 or 9 pirates. But these guys have friends in the area. There are other ships. There are other pirates. And you don't really want to get into a pitched battle. In pitched battle, you lose people. And even if you won, what would happen if, you know... You won, but you lost half your guys, and the rest of you were hurt. I mean, that's not worth it. So he understands how people think, and he understands the lay of the land. So he's got a plan. What's his plan?
It's to show more power than they actually have.
That's right.
They have to make it look like they have all this power, and they're going to attack and they're going to all the ships, when in fact they don't.
That's right.
Horn and signals.
Yeah, there are, and there are plenty of examples in military history of a smaller force tricking either a larger force or a city under siege, and getting them to think that there's a lot more of them than there really are. And so that's his idea. You know, make yourselves look super spick and span, and have all of the soldiers on deck, and have everybody with, you know, their full armament and all the flags and everything else look like you are simply the vanguard of a fleet. Look like you are the vanguard. You are the you're just the landing party of an entire army. You know, as a matter of fact, in a very obvious way, start signaling to all these other ships that don't exist. Because of the lay of the island, there would be a spot where the people could see you, and you could see ships on the other side, but they couldn't see those ships. Therefore, if you're signaling to somebody, they're going to totally assume there are ships out there we can't see. They're not going to assume they're tricking us. Number one, they're not that creative. And number two, what about the governor? What about his character?
Oh my gosh.
He's easily.
Yeah.
He was kind of what they call him, chicken hearted.
He says chicken hearted. He is a petty bureaucrat.
Yeah, and he'll be fooled.
Who has no courage of his own. So if you give him the chance to fight, he may try to, you know, find a sneaky way to fight. But if you overwhelm him early on, he will back down immediately. So, Caspian and Burn are reunited with the Don Treader. They take his advice. They raise up all the flags. They do a bunch of signaling. They polish their armor. And what happens when they come into town?
Well, Burn has already sent a message over there. So there's people greeting them, and
crowds come.
That's
cheering,
right.
Cheering.
So,
they recognize him as the king.
That's right. So Burn has... Burn's done a little advanced preparation, and he's got bells ringing, and he's got people coming, and he's got the word spread. Oh, the King of Narnia.
Oh, great.
Now, what's useful about that?
The people that are in support of him are going to come out and
welcome him. Follow the procession, and it's going to be like a big crowd.
And it's
going to,
it
makes it look more powerful.
It looks huge now because all these people are there. I mean, this is a very, very sideways point, but it's something that I've had to do on a couple of occasions, just not in this specific circumstance. There is a principle of diffusing a dangerous or violent situation. And first time I saw it was in a prison situation, that the use of overwhelming force is to actually reduce harm than to create it. If you have a prisoner who's acting up and is, you know, I'm not gonna come out of my cell, I'm gonna be violent, I'll kill anybody who comes to get me. You've gotta do something about that, right? If you send in one officer, what does that encourage the guy to do? Fight. If you send in 20, so there's no room in that cell to even breathe, the guy usually just gives up. So it's like it's not worth starting. But if you give him something that he thinks he has a chance, then he's going to give his all out. So you don't even go with three or four. You go in with this overwhelming, ridiculous number, and it just discourages the behavior even starting. What I see in this parade is they're swelling their numbers to the point, even if these are just people who are happy to not be going to school, like some of these boys are, that if any of these local soldiers or guards who could have done something see these overwhelming numbers, they're just not going to fool with it. Just let it go.
Didn't Gump's people, they were told that they better clean up their armor. And
right, so what happens when they actually...
So they're there, too.
What happens when they actually get to, like, this, like, the governor's residence or area of the city or whatever? There's a doorway and a doorman, and they, you know, open up in the name of the king, and how does that little interaction go?
Not very well. They said he can't come in.
Well, he barely even got that out. Between the doorman and the guards behind the door, what does it tell you about the state of affairs in Malone Island?
Pitiful.
Yeah, I mean, it's what we might refer to as a kleptocracy, where it's run by the greedy. It's run by the petty bureaucrat who wants to talk about appointments and rules and council meetings and procedures and probably pockets quite a bit.
And line his pocket.
And everybody else knows they're just in this kind of cushy job and nobody really cares and there's no real danger. So even the guards they're all sloppy and they're just laying around and eating in the middle of the day and everything is just
a mess. Well, they aren't held accountable.
Nobody
cares.
Nobody cares, so they do what they want. And after they shut up the doorman and they sort of kick their way in, there's the potential that these soldiers could have put up a fuss. What does Caspian do to head them off of the pass?
He moves on the governor very quickly.
Before he even gets to the governor, we've got these soldiers, and there's a moment where if the soldiers were maybe thinking more clearly or weren't quite so surprised, they could have actually resisted. And Caspian kind of disarms the whole thing immediately. What does he do? He didn't come. And it's interesting how he does it. It's really clever.
He pardons them for their sloven.
Yes. Now, here's an interesting thing about tricking people. If you've ever watched movies or read stories about con men, confidence men, the cons, when they're explained in advance, typically sound ridiculous. But if they're presented in this not only positive way, but this just kind of overwhelmingly truthful way, people can get swept away. If Caspian had come in and say, look, I don't want any trouble, and he kind of came in sort of soft, what might they do? Who the heck are you?
Yeah.
But he comes in like a ton of bricks, as though he were leading an army of hundreds, and he is the rightful king. But instead of trying to sneak it by, he goes overboard And he basically says, well, all of you could be, you know, whipped and flogged and hung for this, but in my mercy, I will pardon you, but you must be in better shape by tomorrow.
I like that you opened a cask of wine.
Captain, I want you to open a cask of wine for this man. And if the captain had any sense of, wait a second, what's going on here, by then all the soldiers are like, free wine, I'm in. I'm with that guy. I'm with the guy who's giving me wine. So Caspian manages to, you know, kind of work all this out, and then they go into Gump's
his office.
His office. And how does he handle the governor?
Very forcefully.
Forcefully. They grab the table and throw it away.
Yank him out of the throne, sit Caspian in there, the naked sword across his lap. This is it's not only a show of authority, it's a show of force. And what's Gump's response?
There's nothing in the correspondence about this.
He doesn't know what to do.
So Caspian is now sitting as a king, and he's now decreeing what's going to happen. What does he say is going to happen?
Slavery is going to go away.
It's done. But our economy and our progress and
he lays out how it doesn't do anything for the economy.
But even if it did, he says, we're still going to get rid of it. It is an evil in and of itself. I see this as being of no help to you economically. But you know what? Even if it was, we're not doing it anymore. And that's not your decision. Whose decision is it? It's mine. What is his response to when Gumpus starts trying to treat him like a small child and try to, well, you don't understand. This is the way of the world, and this is, you're standing in the way of progress. What's Caspian's response?
That the slave trade isn't really doing anything good for the community. That it's just lining his pockets.
Very true. And Caspian manages to pull out that very fun line about progress. Anybody remember that one?
No. We call it going bad?
Yes. I've seen the same thing in an egg.
Yeah, we call it going bad.
Yeah, and in Narnia we call that going bad. Lewis will have little references to this periodically. Sometimes there is, and it's a rhetorical technique to dismiss someone else's claims as being simply not on the side of progress. That progress becomes a thing in and of itself. It's a good, just for progress for progress's sake. And Lewis will periodically, within many of his works, because that was it's something we hear today, and it's something he heard back in the 40s and 50s, 30s, 40s, and 50s. Progress, progress, progress. And Lewis will want to remind people that progress is not a good in and of itself. It all depends on your destination. If you are progressing in the wrong direction, that's not progress at all. What is progress is turning around and going where you want to go. So he sort of rolls that little thought in here because Gumpus is trying to almost kowtow Caspian, like, oh, you don't, you know, you're such a young man, you're such a new king, you don't understand that this is how the world works, you don't understand that in order for us to prosper economically, that this is about, you know, we didn't do this a long time ago, but things have changed. There's progress here. And this is how we're going to continue to develop our little island, blah, blah, blah. And Caspian simply says, well, yeah, things have changed, but change in and of itself can be for the better or for the worse. So, with Gumpus saying, well, I absolutely can't, you know, stop the slave trade, and I can't do this, and I can't do that, what's Caspian's response?
He's going to relieve him of the process.
Well, great, then you're not governor anymore.
Yep.
And you gotta get out of here.
Yeah.
Either with or without a flogging.
That's right. Yeah. So, yeah, because now you've got all the little workers who have come in and they see their meal ticket getting kicked up. Like, well, no, you can't do this, you can't do this. And like, actually,
I can.
And so instead of having a governor, what is the decision Caspian makes about the Long Islands?
Vern is going to be a duke.
You don't coronate them, you...
Knight them.
I don't know, whatever he does.
He nominated.
But he proclaims Lord Byrne to be the Duke, his vassal, but in charge. So no more governors, no more bureaucracies. There's another little Lewis thing coming in. Just the concept of the bureaucracy annoys him. So now we're going to have a responsible, wise person in charge in Lord Byrne. And we're going to strengthen those ties between Narnia and the Lone Islands. Lord Byrne will be my duke. And if you think of the rank of in the English monarchy, duke is as high as you go.
Before prince.
Underneath the actual, you know, succession to reigning, you are, you know. I don't think you're in the succession to be sovereign, but that's basically like the very next level down. As a matter of fact,
Prince William and his
that's
and
right.
His wife
they were
Duchess
of Cambridge, I believe. Mm-hmm. And so that was something that happened with their wedding. So that was a title conferred upon them to kind of sort of sweeten the pot. Like you two are the future of the country.
Yeah.
And there were certain hereditary titles. Prince of Wales, for instance, is typically, you can be prince
that's
of a lot
Charles.
Of places.
Yeah.
The Prince of Wales has in it an understanding that you're next in line.
That's a succession.
Anyway, that's just to throw out that he's given Lord Byrne like a top title. It's not just a little thing. He's a number one guy. So we have to wrap this up because we've taken care of how the governance will happen from here on out. But what do we need to fix right now?
Get Lucy and
we still have Lucy Edmund, Eustace and Reefacheep who are going to be sold as slaves. So they head down to the slaver's market and what happens?
They've already been sold. But he proclaims that there is no longer going to be slavery, and all slaves are slavery.
Yes. So, Lucy and Edmund were, you know, obviously strong, hardy, and hale, and got snapped up. And so, it's actually someone from Kalerman. These are Kalerman traders who bought them. And that's where you kind of get a little bit of a physical description. And so, how do they respond to hearing that their property has just been relieved of them?
They want their money back.
But they do so in this very flowery, formal, elegant, very deferential way. But at the heart of the matter, they want their money back.
Want their money back.
Right. Okay. And so what is Caspian going to do?
Give them their money back. Well, not make sure they get their money back.
Pug the pirate, you're going to give everybody their money back, and you're not going to sell a single one ever again.
Right.
But.
Oh well.
Too bad. You've profited off the misery of others. Better to be a beggar.
Better than a slave.
Is this, where's my other friend?
And so, what happened to Eustace?
Nobody.
Huh? Nobody wanted to die.
Sulky. It's called Sulky.
Bring out Sulky.
Sulky, please.
They couldn't give him away. They tried to make somebody take him in the sale of a group, and they still wouldn't take him. Oh, Eustace. Anyone remember the short story, The Ransom of Red Chief?
Oh, yes, I remember that.
Who wrote it?
Oh, Henry, maybe?
Okay.
But if it wasn't O. Henry, it was somebody like him.
Yeah,
okay.
Yeah.
But basically, this Dennis the Menace kind of kid gets kidnapped, and the parents are like, oh well, just give it some time, and they wind up they keep contacting to say, you know, I know we said $100, but
we'll take
50. We'll take 25. And in the end, the kidnappers bring him
pay.
Back, and they have to pay the parents to keep
him.
It's a funny story.
It sounds like it.
Sounds like
Henry.
Henry does it.
So that's kind of old Eustace here. He's just such a pill that nobody even wants him for free. Which of course has soured his mood, because at the end of the day he still considers himself quite superior. And now you've had a little lesson in how obnoxious and unlikable everybody assumes that you are. So I don't know that he's chastened, but he's definitely mad.
Of course you haven't found the British common sense
He hasn't mellowed a bit.
Alright, so how does this chapter conclude?
But they fit up the ship to go further, looking for those six lords, but the Duke warns them that they're headed towards war, probably, with the Kellerman.
So something very significant could happen in Kellerman. I mean, we were able to sort of smooth this one over, but I don't know about that. What can he tell them about the other lords, or about what's going to happen east of here?
Only that they set up.
Pretty much nothing. They even go to the bars and the pubs looking for old sailors and fishermen, asking for stories about what's east, and what do they get?
Nothing.
Not much
at all. A couple of tall tales, but a whole lot of, well, no, I didn't actually see that, but I heard that story from my own dad. So as they set off, and they're going to set off east, what are they going into?
The unknown.
The absolute unknown. They truly do not know from here on out what they will find. And Bert even says, you know, it's been a long time and we've never heard back. That leads me to believe that they're all long gone, and you know, you're kind of putting yourself out here doing this. Why don't you just stay? But he has made an oath, which he will keep because he is a virtuous king. And what else?
Reaper
Chief. You made a promise with Reaper Chief. You don't want to fool with that. No, there's no good way to tell Reaper Chief we're not going further. So we're just gonna go. So they're restocked and resupplied, and they're ready to head out into the unknown. This is a very small detail that gets passed along, but Edmund notices. How long of a trip are they looking at right now? Based off of their supplies, what are they actually stocked for?
Oh,
2 weeks.
Yeah, that's right.
2 weeks. 2 weeks. He estimates they have about 28 days worth of supplies. Now, in a ship, that doesn't mean 28 days of sailing.
No.
That means half of that out, because you still have to get half back. Because if you go all the way and there's nothing, you've got to turn around.
Right.
Otherwise, you starve and you die. So ultimately, Edmund calculates they've got 2 weeks or less before they need to see something. You know, now if they find another island they can restock, then obviously that changes the equation. But we have no idea what's out there. And if it's dead empty sea for 2 weeks, that's as far as we're going to be able to go. So, this is pretty ambitious when you think about it. To head up into the true unknown, they've stocked themselves up as well as possible, but honestly, it's not that much. So,
and they're alone. It's only one ship.
It's one ship. It's one ship. And if you've ever been out past the horizon, no matter how big that ship is, in the middle of the ocean, it is suddenly very, very small.
It is.
So,
does this?
Yeah.
So, chapters 5 and 6 for next week.
Okay.
All right, we'll see you then.
Thank you.